Welcome to Not Another Anxiety Show. I'm your host, Kelly Walker, and joining me today is guest Yael Shai. Hi, Yael.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, really happy to be here.
Now, do you mind if I share a little bit more about you with our listeners before we get started here?
No, go for it. That would be wonderful.
Wonderful. Yael Shai is the founder and director of Mindful NYU, the largest campus-wide meditation initiative in the country, and the senior director of the Center for Global Spiritual Life at New York University. She leads meditation workshops, classes, and retreats around the country and the world. She has been published in the Harvard Business Review, Huffington Post, and the Journal of Interreligious Studies, among other publications. Yael lives in Brooklyn with her husband and son. More information on Yael can be found at www.yaelshai.com, which is Y-A-E-L, Shai, S-H-Y. Is that right?
That's right. All one word, or all smushed together.
All smushed together. Now, you also recently authored and published a book called What Now? Meditation for Your 20s and Beyond. Can you tell us a little bit more about that book? Because I'm about two-thirds through, and I'm finding it a really valuable resource.
Oh, good. I'm so glad. Yeah, it is. It's a journey, really, of my meditation journey, how I came into meditation. It includes a lot of memoir and a lot of pieces of my life, how I started actually really deeply from a place of struggle and suffering when I was in college. I was 19 and being consumed by anxiety and panic and really existential questions about what my purpose was in life, as a lot of the pieces of my life were kind of crumbling around me. And then I went on a meditation retreat. I started to learn to understand a lot of the pieces that were underlying the anxiety and the panic and the fear. And then I break that down into different sections about how to meditate. And I try and talk about it in a way that is really, really easy and accessible, because that's what I always wish that I had. And then talk about meditation and mindfulness in everyday life, in social media, in relationships, in sex, in these kind of overwhelming feelings that I felt all the time when I was in my 20s and even into 30s, like fear, anger, desire. And then I include a section at the end that goes into how do we make change in the world? How do we create a more socially just world without burning out or feeling alienated or just angry? And that's really the course of the book.
And I'm sure you get this a lot, but I feel like your story, your experience of your early 20s, like mirrors mine. I was like, I feel like I'm reading about myself, because so often, you know, the 20s, as we come into young adulthood and independence, there was just this existential anxiety left me feeling like, where is my place in the world?
Yes.
Lost, like a subtle discontentment and a searching. And again, one of my favorite things about this book is it is so relatable. It's just so human. It's not at all inaccessible. It's wonderful. Mm.
Oh, yes. And I think, thank you. And I think that it really is. I remember when I was that age and feeling like people, when I would look up or try and find resources about how to deal with these kinds of massive questions I was facing, like, you know, what is our point and who am I? And the resources that were out there were often about like how to deal with the stress of too much homework, you know, like use a stress ball or take a warm bath, which are all nice things, but it was like not answering these big questions. And I think the questions deserve to be answered. And there's so much wisdom out there. And you share so much of it on your show about there really are tools that you can use to go on this path to finding the places in your life where you can really have meaning and connection.
Yeah. And if you don't mind me asking, what helped you kind of click? What helped meditation click even in the midst or throes of anxiety and panic attacks? Like, I know for me, I don't think anybody really explained what the actual, oh God, I goal's not even a good word, but like what the process of meditation is. I remember just being kind of like you were told, oh, take a bubble bath or go for a walk. Okay, just meditate. And the meaning was totally lost on me. You know, I'd kind of sit down to do it and still feel panicked and anxious. And I'm like, oh, well, clearly I'm a failure. This isn't working. What helped it click for you? Did you just have good instruction in the beginning? Did you kind of understand, you know, just that meditation isn't necessarily to clear the mind or to calm down. It's actually like a look into our own souls, like a waking up. Did someone help you kind of understand that?
Yes, they did. But I talk about in the book that I kind of went about it in the craziest possible way because I also thought that meditation was just like about kind of sitting in a cross-legged position and like emptying the mind, and that appealed to me like 0%. So I was like not interested. I never had even done a yoga class at that point. Like I just thought like it sounded so boring and so alien to my experience. And what I did was I completely, without knowing it, went on a 7-day silent meditation retreat without really fully
Without
understanding
knowing
it.
it. Culture shock, right? When you first got there.
Yes. I mean, I understood we'd be meditating on the retreat, but I thought it was going to be like, an hour a day. I didn't understand that from like the moment you wake up in the morning until you go to sleep at night for 7 days, it was meditation, really sitting and walking and eating meditation and silence, complete silence. And so I really got thrown into a deep end, the deep end. And so in the beginning, I had all of those thoughts, like you are a complete failure. You can't even stay with your breath for more than 2 breaths, maybe. I kept doing things in the meditation hall that then they would announce to the group, like our rules that you should not be doing. I would lay down and take a nap. I would like bring my book into the room and just read. And so I was really struggling. And then I think about halfway through is when that crack through came, and it came through talking with a teacher and the teacher telling me, really try and look exactly what you said, look at the fear itself. Ask the fear, like what's underneath it? Can you shine a light on it? Can you see what's happening? And because of all of that meditation practice that I thought was such a failure, and because of that silent container, I could actually really see and hear some of the pieces that were underneath the fear, some of the storylines and the pain that I was carrying around. And so I think that's when I finally kind of understood what the point of meditation was, that it wasn't exactly like you're saying, like it wasn't just about calming down in the moment or reaching like a state of no thoughts or anything like that.
It's waking up, right? We're just trying to kind of wake up to our experience and see it for what it actually is.
Exactly. Instead of what we normally do, which is just believe every thought that comes into our mind, which then makes us crazy.
I'll never forget. It seems like such a common sense, anticlimactic sentence, but I'll never forget the first time I was like, wait. I don't know that this thought is a fact. Like, I'm not sure my thoughts are facts. And for a good 25 years, I trusted them as so, the objective truth, fact. And I know for me, that's been a real gift in meditation, is just kind of seeing some of the ridiculousness in the stories and seeing them for stories instead of just absolute truth.
Exactly. Yeah, I remember on that same retreat, I was sitting trying to meditate, eyes closed, and for this like interminable period of time. And then I sort of saw that somebody rang the bell and everybody was getting up and moving. And then I opened my eyes and I realized I had just made it up. Like nobody had rang the bell, nobody was getting up and moving. And my mind had just kind of put that out there as like a kind of a imagination daydream. And it just rocked me in a moment, exactly like you're describing, where I was like, wow, my mind, I'm awake right now. And my mind just made up something in such clarity and crisp detail that I really thought it happened. And that's what so much of my anxiety was. It was these forecasting of bad things that I was pretty sure would happen once my mind made those pictures up. And then, you know, with absolutely no evidence that they would happen. And so that was such a huge breakthrough for me.
Yeah. And I know you kind of mentioned that in the book, like anxiety and apprehension and those things are very future oriented, you know, forecasting. Yes. And so the kind of antidote to that is to come back to the present because it's all we have. But like you said, I'm guessing that felt, especially because you plunged yourself into the deep end head
right.
first, I'm guessing that felt really unnatural at first, or hard or challenging and struggle, you know, kind of like when we struggle to learn to ride a bike and we're wobbling around to figure it out. Did it feel pretty difficult at first?
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, and my students tell me this all the time, like, why do I want to be in the present if the present is unpleasant? Why is that optimal? And I think the truth is there often is a lot of unprocessed, painful things we're carrying around, especially in the beginning when we first start our practice, that really facing them and looking at them is terrifying.
Yes.
And unpleasant and all of that. And we spend most of our time avoiding. But the problem is that the avoiding also hurts. And I venture to think hurts more. It's actually more contributing to our suffering. So, you know, once you actually commit yourself to saying, okay, it's scary, I'm scared, but I'm gonna do it. I'm gonna like actually sit with what's here, examine it, be with it, open to it. To me, the relative pain and suffering is so much less than constantly shoving it away or running from it or fighting it and having it in that way rule your life.
Yeah, I know you kind of mentioned that in your book when you're speaking to like some of the barriers that leave us feeling like we're a failed meditator, and one of them is aversion or avoidance, right? There's
yes.
like the initial aversion or avoidance, but then when we're kind of fighting it, not willing to look at it, constricting from it, it's like then it's layer after layer after layer
right.
of aversion. And then suddenly it feels very compounded, very overwhelming, and like I absolutely cannot handle this. And what has kind of helped you work with, because I think I know you list kind of a few barriers or instances where we're left feeling like we have maybe failed, but I just thought aversion, avoidance was most prevalent when it comes to at least anxiety and fear. It's, you know, fear is really defined by aversion, avoidance,
yes.
you know, behavior and reactivity. So what helps you work with aversion? Like what makes hanging out, is it just practice hanging out with that feeling that makes it feel just a little more doable, or how do you kind of work with aversion?
Yeah, I think for me, it takes a lot of reframing of the entire experience. So when I define success, a meditation success, as like I stayed with my breath and I didn't have thoughts, then it's inevitably going to go in a bad direction, and then I'm going to be beating myself up and it's horrible. But if I And this is the science actually tells us that what, you know, all the goodies we get from meditation, all of the kind of benefits to our chemical makeup and to our brain often happen not when we're just sitting in blissful no thought land, but at the moment when we actually return back to our breath, when we kind of wake up, do a mini little wake up out of a daydream or a thought and come back. And so I kind of, to me, like that initial avoidance of wanting to be present is that avoiding of a feeling of being a failure when I can't be. And so to reframe it and say, like, meditation is not about like the success of how many breaths you can stay with, how much you've stayed in the moment. It's just about the willingness to keep coming back over and over again. And that's when the good things happen. That's when you show yourself through that returning that you're, that you, in some ways, it's like sort of an act of love. Like, yeah. I am worth returning to. This moment is worth returning to. I'm going to forgive every other moment that came before and just open my heart back up and come back. And so there's no such thing. I know people say this all the time, but it's really true. There's really no such thing as failing at meditation, because all you know, as long as you're there and you're committed, you know, something is happening to you. And so that's one way I deal with the avoiding of it. And that's what kind of helped me to develop a regular practice. The Buddhist answer to how to deal with aversion is, and that's like aversion of all kinds. That's like, right. I don't want to meditate. Somebody else's loud breathing is really bothering me. This chair,
my dog is barking. Oh, exactly. How am I supposed to meditate with my dog barking?
Exactly. Like, this world is just too distracting. Like, when you're having all of those kinds of aversive thoughts, the Buddha actually said that the antidote to that is a kind of loving kindness practice, to wishing yourself and other people well through the meditation, like over and over again. It's called like a metta practice. And there's this famous story of, like, he sent his monks out into the wilderness, and it was cold and uncomfortable and unpleasant. And they were like afraid, because it was like they were on their own out there. And they came back, and or maybe it was like before they left, they said, we don't want to go. What are we supposed to do? And he taught them this practice of sending out love as the antidote to this other way of being, which is constricted and avoidant and aversive. And sometimes when I'm in aversion, I can do that. I can send it out. But oftentimes what helps me a lot is actually to send it in and to say, like, poor baby, this is really hard. I'm just, you know, really bring a lot of love to myself and compassion to my experience, and to just say, like, you know, may I feel at ease and let that just wash over me. May I feel safe and let that wash over me, and just stay with those phrases over and over again, almost like a mantra. And when I'm in deep aversion, sometimes that can be really helpful.
Yeah, because I think the instinct, right, is when we're in deep aversion, if it's toward someone else, or again, sometimes I'll feel it toward my poor dog, who's a rescue and doing the best that she can. But when she gets going with barking and I get frustrated, you know, there'll be that trying to send her goodwill and have understanding for experience. And then I'm like, well, I know I should have understanding, but I don't right now. And I'm sick of her. And like, I wish she'd stop barking. And so I kind of like, I like that, that insight is to like send it towards myself. Like, wow, you're pretty overwhelmed right now. Like, you're having a hard time seeing, you know, skies are cloudy, the weather's a bit foggy, visibility's low. Okay. Like, if I can't make it happen for someone else, you know, do my best to kind of just have a bit of compassion for my own experience. It feels a little more doable.
Right. And then from there, often I find like, okay, then I have some space for
a little
other
more
people.
Softening. Yeah. There's usually a little more softening.
Yes.
Hard to soften if we're shaming ourselves for being mean, bad, cruel people.
Right. Or judgmental, all of that stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, do you mind just sharing a little bit? I know you mentioned how you struggled with anxiety and panic attacks in your book. What did it kind of look like for you? Was it a very physical experience? Was it more like, you know, mental activity? Was it a little bit of both? Like, what was it like for you? How did it show up?
Yeah, so I have been an anxious, I think I was an anxious person from birth. Like, I can't say it for sure, but my mother tells me that when I was a baby, I was very clingy and kind of, you know, scared a lot, like easily scared. And my entire childhood, I just remember carrying around like this churning feeling in my stomach that things might not be okay and things might not be safe. And I was worried all the time that something bad would happen. And I just kind of barely coped with it throughout my childhood. So when I got to college, it's like all of that just low-level anxiety that I was carrying just kind of went through the roof. And it happened to coincide with September 11th, and I was living in New York, about 15 minutes away from the Twin Towers when that happened. And so then I think what everyday anxiety then quickly became was some mix of anxiety and post-traumatic stress disorder. And so then the panic attacks became like really intense. So it was physical for sure. Like I would start just being in a setting, and I had several different kinds of triggers, like crowds or loud noises. And whenever that would happen, I would just start like sweating, or I would kind of try and instinctually kind of duck and cover for a second. Like I had a very strong startle reflex. And a lot of the stuff that is very textbook PTSD, but I didn't really know that at the time. And when I would just start, and probably the largest symptom I had was just being unable to breathe, like chest constricting and having a really hard time breathing. And so yeah, I guess I hadn't really had panic attacks of that kind, of that severity before then, but I just had a lot of anxiety and stomach pain. It would always manifest as stomach pain.
In the gut, right?
Yes. Yes. It felt like it was like my constant friend that was also like an enemy.
A
A frenemy.
frenemy.
Yes.
And what did meditation kind of allow you to see or understand about your own anxiety that was like the most, eye-opening for you or helpful for you?
So many things, but I guess the headline would be that I think when I first started looking underneath, what am I actually afraid of? If I had to kind of sum up what's boiling underneath all this fear, at first I thought like, well, it's that I'm not lovable, or that the world isn't safe, I'm not safe, and all of that was true. But underneath that was this fear of being a fear of dying. And then that can't stand alone, because I figured, well, actually, I've never died. So what am I imagining dying to be? Because that's really the crux of it, is like, what do I think dying is? And so when I dug a little under that, I found, I think that dying is kind of a being rendered invisible and being like being worthless, completely not gone, like to the point that you're gone, that you're nothing. And I grew up in a family of like many children, and my mother was like very overwhelmed. And I think that feeling of being like invisible, worthless, I'm a middle child. I don't know if that had anything to do with it, but I think that was the thing I had already experienced. And so anxiety over time was kind of building on that core thing, that core pain that I had already experienced. And then I was projecting into the future of like, that feeling is so bad that I never, ever, ever want to feel that way again. So how can I protect myself through constant worrying
And
and
vigilance, right? How can I
vigilance?
armor up?
Yes, exactly. Against ever feeling that way again, when the truth is, I was carrying it with me all the time. So I think through meditation, when I started to see these things and see the narratives and seeing all of the stories that I was carrying with me, I could turn towards those stories, and I could turn towards that little person, myself when I was that really young and first developed that coping mechanism, and just try and hold her with like a lot of love and compassion. And and it was hard, because the first thing that you want to do when you see something like that is be like, oh my gosh, that is the worst thing ever. I never want to feel like that. I hate my anxiety. I want to kill my anxiety. And it was took a lot of like re kind of committing myself in meditation to be like, I can't kill my anxiety. What I can do is try and love it, and try and be with it, and try and hold it, and make room, and just make and become big enough that it can just come into my body and out of my body and almost wash through me and be a part of my experience and no longer be the center stage. And so that's really how I practice for years and years, and still kind of do when fear comes up and when anxiety comes up.
Yeah. And you know, it kind of sounds like one of the most helpful aspects of meditation for anxiety is it eliminates the smoke screens. Like, as you know, panic is such a physical, intense experience, and anxiety can be too, like very hijacking and overwhelming. And it's so easy to think that the anxiety itself is the problem. Like, oh, I can't breathe right now. This is the problem. This is what I need to solve. This is what I need to look at. And I think meditation just says, you know, I know that, you know, I know it has helped me see, you know, that may look like the problem right now. It's very intense, but actually anxiety is a messenger. It's not in and of itself a problem. It just has something to say, something to share. And sometimes it's valuable. Sometimes it's an old story that doesn't serve us, you know, or an old belief. But I think that's what meditation, it helped me see through the smoke screen so that I could really move forward and heal.
That's a beautiful way to put it. Yes, because I think it really did develop naturally in often for survival. Yeah. And so it's not worth kind of spending a lot of energy hating it and, you know, trying to beat it back. But to understand and to see what we're going to do with it is the question.
Yeah. And, you know, I know your book says for people in their 20s and beyond, I'm in my 30s and I still find it, you know, incredibly, incredibly valuable. But
thank you.
What do you see, you know, kind of working on a campus with people in their early 20s, like late teens, early 20s? Are you seeing a benefit or a trend in kind of teaching this mindfulness meditation? I know I wish they taught it to me in high school. I wish it was a part of health class, like emotional competence could have, learning how to move through or move with emotions was something I know I could have used. So
yes, absolutely.
Do you see it's kind of like setting younger people up for the challenges that really come with young adulthood? Is it's hard, it's challenging. And do you kind of see the meditation helping them move through that with just a little more wisdom or ease? Or what are you seeing as the benefit in helping people understand meditation at an earlier age?
Yeah, well, it's actually not just me. It's like research study after study shows that, first off, on the one hand, this generation coming up, I felt pretty anxious myself, but the research says that this generation that, you know, between the millennials and what they're calling like the Generation Z, that's underneath.
Is that what the
millennials?
I was wondering what the next generation was called actually this week. So you answered my question.
That's it.
Generation Z. Okay.
Yeah. There's some people are calling them the I generation,
like iPhone.
Exactly. Yeah, okay. But either way, that their anxiety levels are higher than every other generation that's come before them, like off the charts anxiety levels. And there's almost a new article that comes out on this every week, because it's people are hypothesizing, and there's some research to support it, that this is a result of actually just unmitigated phone usage and social media, being on social media all the time.
A constant reactive state, right? I mean, it's like the fight or flight response never gets a rest.
That's right. And it's funny because actually, you know, there's other research that says this is the safest time for anybody to ever be alive, like if you take society as a whole. Mm-hmm. And so it's a kind of a funny mix that they're feeling the most unsafe in the safest time that has ever existed. And I think it's just that function of just endless information bombardment and expectation of keeping up on these social media platforms, and loneliness and alienation. Yeah. So we're also seeing, and this I don't have like the hard data to support, but anecdotally, every single year we see more and more and more young people coming into our meditation classes here at NYU where I work. And seeking out meditation and having had exposure to it already, because I think meditation has broken through into the zeitgeist in a way that was never true when I was young. And so I think it's now so mainstream that there are way more numbers of young people have had some exposure, and they're also seeking it in greater numbers and hungry for these practices. Like just like we're saying, not just to be like to calm down, but to understand life better and to disconnect from the device and connect into themselves better. And so, and I see that over and over again. I would say, in anecdotally, the number one issue, there's all kinds of issues that many of our students come to me with, but the probably number one is just this kind of anxiety. So, very apropos for your show, and very hungry for these practices. And so that was one of the main reasons why I wrote the book, in addition to just wishing that I had had something like that when I was young.
Yeah. And I, again, the way it's written, I would have been able to comprehend that in my early 20s. It wouldn't have felt it wouldn't have felt unrelatable. You know, it feels so like if I had read that during my early 20s experience, it would have been like, yes, this is exactly what my life looks like. And definitely a much needed resource. At least it was for me, you know, 10 years ago or so.
Yes. Yeah. I feel that way too, that I went on my first meditation retreat. I was probably the youngest person there by like 45 years.
We're changing the face of it, right? It's not.
Yeah. Just... It was definitely not as popular as it is now.
Yeah. It's a bit of, you know, in some ways that's really good that it's a buzzword, and it's losing a lot of its preconceived notions and misconceptions. And it's a wonderful thing because, again, when I understood what it was really about, when I was kind of educated about, you know, the true meaning behind it, it was so beneficial compared to, like, again, when I was in the throes of anxiety, it was, oh, just meditate or do a relaxation meditation or do, like, without the understanding behind it. You might have well told me to, you know, go to the moon. Like it felt right. So impossible. Like it felt so unattainable. And so it's, I'm glad that it is, you know, understanding what it's all about is so much more accessible now because, yeah.
How did you learn that?
What I know now?
So, yes. Or like around meditation.
Yeah. So a couple of classes with Tara Brach, a few different apps. Just, I remember being so baffled that, oh, like success is getting distracted and coming back. To really kind of see what your mind is up to, you have to come back. And in order to do that, you have to get distracted. And oh, yes. Like I didn't realize that's, I don't know if the word success, but like at least an imperative part of the process.
It's, yes.
Yeah. And that it wasn't to calm down. So that's how I had been taught, was use this to calm your anxiety. And I couldn't stand being in my own body. So paying attention to the breath when I felt like I couldn't breathe just kind of compounded my experience. It was like, you want me to what? And I'd start panicking even more. And it was when I learned, okay, well, you don't have to start with that anchor. You know, you can start with a walking meditation, which is, I know for me was super helpful when anxiety was high.
And right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that the breath is, it's like not about, it's not just about the breath. The breath is like useful because it's always there and it calms down the nervous system.
Yeah.
But when you're in the throes of it, that's not the only place to connect to in meditation, for sure.
Right. That there's options, and it's, you know, it just didn't look anything like I thought it did or how I was taught, which was a pleasant surprise.
Yes. Yeah, it's wonderful.
Now, remind us where we can find you.
Yes. So, again, my website has kind of all the information on it, from pieces that I've written to places that I'm teaching. And that's YAELS, like Sam, HY.com. And then I'm on all the social medias, YAELSHY1. and would love to connect and to keep talking. And the book makes a good holiday present. So consider that it's on sale everywhere. And so, thank you.
Yes. Thank you so much for taking the time to hop on the show again. I know this is usually a pretty busy month, holiday season and whatnot. So thank you for coming on.
It's my absolute pleasure. Really good to talk to you.
That's our episode. Thanks so much for tuning in today. If you're enjoying the show, please subscribe and take a minute to write a review on iTunes so that we can reach and support more people. If you're looking for more resources like one-on-one coaching, courses, or have a question you'd like answered on the show, please visit notanotheranxietyshow.com. You can also get a free ebook there by subscribing to my newsletter. And until next time, remember, be kind to yourself.